The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. If you have any questions or would like to become a sponsor, please contact our office at 919-832-5138. And we're continuing on with the genius issue, which I'm sure all of us are well familiar with, since we're all geniuses, in our own minds anyway. And so we'll go with innovations. The minds at DARPA, the ARPA, are creating another batch of science-worthy tools to fend off most any kind of enemy and shape up civilian life, too. Inventing the soldier of the future. And there's a picture of a young man standing on what looks like an advanced treadmill. He's all wired up. He's got gear all over him. He's got electronics strapped to his back and to his legs and to his chest. And he's standing there just like he's ready to go. And the title of the thing is, DARPA's Warrior Web Exoskeleton Could Help Soldiers and Civilians Carry Heavy Loads. To get the upper hand in any scenario, the U.S. military has often relied upon the most outlandish innovations the mind can conjure. Stealth technology, bionic limbs, and a little thing called Internet all started with the military, specifically as brain children of the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, the 60-year-old fount of new technology in soldiering. Reader's Digest reviewed the next wave of advances, looking for those destined to spread. Number 1. Power Walkers. Spend time speaking with foot soldiers and you'll eventually hear about lugging an overstuffed backpack for miles and terrible weather through rough terrain. But the age-old problem of overburdened troops is deadly serious. An army on the move can be dangerously slowed and weakened by strain injuries or just by soldiers struggling under their loads. So the minds at DARPA threw down this gauntlet into scientific community. Build some kind of wearable contraption that would help combatants transport their burdens. It needed to be thin and supple enough to fit under battle uniforms and equipment. To come up with a solution, Ignacio Galeana, Ph.D., and his researchers at Harvard's Wyss Institute for Biologically Inspired Engineering immersed themselves in study a simple act we take for granted, walking. They scrutinized the leg muscles' perfectly timed burst of energy to understand how a walker might get a little assist. What we learned, says Galeana, is that small changes in timing, just a few milliseconds, could make a difference between assisting and hindering someone. So Galeana and his team developed a suit that is essentially a wearable robot, the Warrior Web Exoskeleton. Tiny sensors embedded in the fabric take readings every millisecond or so on how the wearer is moving. The data are fed into a computer housed in a fancy fanny pack. Retractable spooling cables extend from the waist to the ankles. When the system senses fatigue, the cable applies pressure to joints and mimics muscle movement, so you spend less energy moving your legs, the Spanish-born Galeana says. The system is learning how you're walking and adapting the timing and parameters to make sure the assistance is maximizing the brief benefits you get. The program is in its final stages. Prototypes have been delivered to the Department of Defense. And someday, these suits might help civilians, too. The Wyss Institute had licensed technology to a private medical device company to help stroke victims walk again. The invention could also give a weak or elderly person enough of a boost of power his or her way from the store to the car with a load of groceries. The next is a picture of a beautiful-looking thistle with a bright, day-glow pink flower and green stems shooting out from it. And this is interesting. Scientists are engineering thistles that bloom early if a landmine is nearby. Plants that spy. Imagine an innocuous-looking field of poppies in the outskirts of a hostile foreign capital. Suddenly, a surveillance drone zooming in on the fields finds that all the flowers are leaning in the same direction. The poppies have been genetically engineered to bend toward the presence of sarin gas, so American analysts strongly suspect that the country is developing a poison gas program. Without question, the ability to detect chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear, and explosive threats is paramount to national security. But with plants? Who comes up with these ideas? Meet Blake Bechstein, Ph.D., a professor of biology at the University of Texas at Tyler, who heads up Advanced Plaque Technologies, APT, program at DARPA. The idea for the APT came from conversations I had with the military. One of the needs they talked about a lot was surveillance. Existing sensors had two problems. They were made most from costly metals and plastics, and they relied on batteries, explained Beckstein. Plants get their energy from the sun, of course, and they're infinitely scalable. Beckstein is used to the outlandish. In 2014, he starred in the reality TV show Tethered. The concept: two polar opposites are forced to survive in the wilderness by bound together by a 6-foot cable. I was put with a practicing shaman, Beckstein says. For 11 days, the pairs climbed up and down hills, hiked over mountains and into valleys, jumped off cliffs, ran into waterfalls, and for the most part got along. My way of approaching things was scientific thought. His way was to pray for things. Learning to work with others to overcome obstacles was a good practice for his time at DARPA. We don't fix small problems, he says. We're supposed to be doing the big ideas, future possibility ideas, so we think a little differently than most people. As different as plant technology is, its foundation is solid. Plants are highly sensitive to what's going on around them, making them excellent sentinels. The trick, of course, is to use genetic engineering to create varieties that will exhibit some predictable, detectable change when exposed to a threat. Plant modification platforms have really taken off in the last 5 to 10 years, says Beckstein. Science is at the right time to do this. APT is just getting underway, but if it's successful, Beckstein say we may see thistles that bloom 2 months early because there are landmines in their field. Closer to home, plants could serve as a warning system for virulent strains of flu, while stream-sized weeds might alert authorities to the presence of toxins in the water. A colleague of mine has said that at DARPA, if you don't produce the next internet, you get a B. As a program manager, I want to make sure I get an A. I think APT is a program that has the possibility of doing that. And the next is an interesting picture. It looks like a framework of a building that's under construction, and up going up one side of that building is a thing that's called a gecko-like rib. Andy Torbett. Geckos, you know, have little tiny things that stick to walls so they can climb up and down sideways. Number 3, wall-climbing commandos. It's midnight, and a commando team needs to replace a sniper on the roof of a glass-walled office building. But the enemy has all the entrances secured, and the element of surprise is crucial. Not to worry. From his pack, the sniper pulls out a lightweight kit, straps some paddles to his hands, and begins scaling the smooth, flat exterior like an exotic lizard. But not just any lizard. A couple of years ago, my son requested a gecko for his birthday, and I have to say, I'm awed by this thing, program manager David Carter, Ph.D., told ScoutCambridge.com. It puts any engineering we can do to shame. It can leap and catch itself with one foot. It's quite remarkable. Today, Carter and his team of engineers at Draper Laboratories in Cambridge, Massachusetts, working with DARPA, are using state-of-the-art nanotechnology methods to mimic his son's pet. They studied the tiny hairs on the gecko's feet that allow it to grip very smooth surfaces, such as plate glass windows, and came up with a material called MicroHold. Then they added it to paddles with suction cups to reduce slippage. Early this year, the British explorer Andy Torbett scaled a 10-story glass building using the lizard-like rig. We were fairly confident we'd do well, but it was a little nerve-wracking, Carter admitted to BizJournals.com. There was a lot of grit and grime on the windows. Speaking of griming windows, MicroHold could do well the solution to safely cleaning those, too. It might also help you hang pictures without marring your drywall or mount speakers on the glass wall of your sunroom. This is about the most fun thing an engineer can get paid to do, says Carter. We've gone from the fundamental physics of how the gecko adheres to the engineering challenge of scaling up to larger and larger sizes. The next thing is a picture of a home. It's actually a drawing of a home. And the title says, one day we might own homes where damaged chimneys heal themselves, roofs breathe to control airflow, and driveways eat spilled oil. Buildings that grow themselves. Sequoia seeds. DARPA program manager Justa Gullivan, Ph.D., is fascinated by them. Specifically, how incredible it is that a tiny seed holds all the genetic material required to shape a 300-foot-tall forest giant. So when Galavan heard that a company called Ecovetiv had discovered that some mushroom cells would feed off farm waste, bind to it, and ultimately grow into molded packing materials and furniture parts, he had an idea. What if, instead of using the lowly mushroom cells from the mighty sequoia, could be induced to do something like that? Would it mean that instead of trucking in lumber to a building site, we can make a structure from living materials that you grew right there? Galavan is not a biologist. In fact, the last biology class he took was in ninth grade. Still, as a professor of chemistry at Emory University, he could easily imagine the defense applications. The military often builds structures in remote and inhospitable parts of the world. Getting the building materials there is costly and time-consuming, and once the structures have been built, they're subject to damage from storms, accidents, wear, and tear. The non-military possibilities of the program, known as Engineered Living Materials, ELM, are just as exciting. A hurricane will destroy thousands of homes in some corner of the globe. With ELM, humanitarian workers might well show up, not with truckloads of lumber, but with a set of lightweight cardboard molds and some seeds. They'll add water and within 3 days have bricks, blocks, tiles, and shingles that are alive and ready to be assembled into buildings. Can you take a seed and grow a living 2x4 reliably every single time? Galavan wonders. Could you program so if you wanted 2x8s? You just use a different seed. And even more out there possibility, creating buildings whose skin heal themselves when cut by, say, a hurricane. Galavan hopes to have proof that the ELM is viable by 2020. Panic in aisle 6. Using self-checkout lane so I don't have to interact with anyone. Scan first item. Register. Please wait for assistance. Health. Surprising new research shows that placebos work even when you know they're not real. The power of fake pills. And there's a picture of a plastic pill bottle with all different kinds of pills popping out of it. Here they are, John Kelly said, taking a paper bag off his desk and pulling out a big amber pill bottle. Inside were the pills we designed, a magical concoction put together to treat any chronic writer's block and a panic attacks and insomnia that have always come along with it. I've known Kelly since we were undergrads together. Now he's a psychology professor at Endicott College in Massachusetts and the deputy director of PIPS, Harvard's Program in Placebo Studies and Therapeutic Encounter. It's the first program in the world devoted to the interdisciplinary study of the placebo effect. The term placebo refers to a dummy pill passed off as a genuine pharmaceutical on, or more broadly, any sham treatment presented as a real one. By definition, a placebo is a deception, a lie. But doctors have been handing them out for centuries, and patients have been getting better, whether through the power of belief or suggestion, or no one's exactly sure. Even today, when the use of placebos is considered unethical by many medical professionals, a survey of 679 doctors showed that about half of them prescribe medications such as vitamins and over-the-counter painkillers primarily for their placebo value. Interestingly, the PIPS researchers have discovered that placebos seem to work well even when a practitioner doesn't try to trick a patient. These are called open-label placebos, or placebos explicitly prescribed as placebos. So I had turned to my old friend for help with my writer's block. I think we can design a pill for that, he told me initially. We'll fine-tune your writing pill for a maximum effectiveness, color, shape, size, dosage, time before writing. What color do you associate with writing well? I closed my eyes. Gold. I'm not sure the pharmacist can do metallic. It may have to be yellow. Over the next few weeks, we discussed my treatment in greater detail. Kelly had suggested capsules rather than pills, so they would look more scientific and therefore have a stronger effect. He also made them short-acting. He believed a 2-hour time limit would cut down on my tendency to procrastinate. We'd composed a set of instructions that covered not only how to take them, but also what we were going to do. Finally, he'd ordered the capsules, which cost a heavy $405, though they contain nothing but cellulose. Placebos are not covered by insurance. Kelly reassured me. The price increases the sense of value. It will make them work better. I called the pharmacy to pay with my credit card. After the transaction, the pharmacist said to me, I'm supposed to counsel customers on the correct way to take their medication. But honestly, I don't know what to tell you about these. My guess is that I can't overdose. That's true. Do you think I could get addicted? Ah, well, that's an interesting question. We laughed, but I felt uneasy. Open Label has started to feel like one of those postmodern magic shows in which the magician explains the illusion even as he performs the trick. Except there was no magician. Everyone was making it up as they went along. One of the key elements of the placebo effect is the way our expectations shape our experience. As Kelly handed over the pills, he wanted to heighten my expectancy, as psychologists call it, as much as possible. He showed me the very official-looking stuff that came with the yellow capsules, the pill bottle, the label, the prescription, the receipt from the pharmacy, and the instruction sheet he had written together, which he read to me out loud. Then he asked whether I had any questions. Suddenly we were in the midst of an earnest conversation about my fear of failure as a writer. There was something about hearing Kelly respond with his gentle manner. As it turned out, that's another key element of the placebo effect, an empathetic caregiver. The healing force, or whatever we are going to call it, passes through the placebo, but it helps if it starts with a person, someone who wants you to get better. Back home, I sat down at the dining room table with a glass of water and a notebook. Take 2 capsules with water 10 minutes before writing, said the label. Below that, placebo, no refills. I unfolded the directions. This placebo has been designed especially for you, to help you write with greater freedom and more spontaneous and natural feeling. It is intended to help eliminate the anxiety and self-doubt that can sometimes act as a drag on your creative self-expression. Positive expectations are helpful but not essential. It is natural to have doubts. Nevertheless, it is important to take the capsules faithfully and as directed because previous studies have shown that adherence to the treatment regimen increases the placebo effect. I swallowed 2 capsules and then, per the instructions, closed my eyes and tried to explain to the pills what I wanted them to do. I became worried that my anxieties about their not working might prevent them from working. Over the next few days, I felt my anxiety level soar while at work and when filling out the self-report sheets. On a scale of 0 to 10, where 0 is no anxiety and 10 is the worst anxiety you have ever experienced, please rate the anxiety you felt during the session today. I was giving myself 8s out of a misplaced sense of restraint, though I wanted to give 10s. Then one day and night in bed, my eyes opened, my heart was pounding. The clock said 3 a.m. I got up and sat in an armchair, and since my pill bottle was there on the desk, took 2 capsules just to calm down. They actually made me feel a little better. In the morning, I emailed Kelly, who wrote back saying that, like any medication, the placebo might take a couple of weeks to build up a therapeutic dose. Ted Kopechick, Kelly's boss and the founder of the director of PIPS, has traveled an eccentric path. He became embroiled in radical politics in the 1960s and studied Chinese medicine in Macao. After returning to the United States, he practiced acupuncture in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and ran a pain clinic before being hired at Harvard Medical School. But he's not a doctor, and the degree he earned in Macao isn't recognized here. Kopechick's outsider status has given him an unusual amount of intellectual freedom. In the intensely specialized world of academic medicine, he routinely crosses the lines between clinical research, medical history, anthropology, and bioethics. They originally hired me at Harvard to do research in Chinese medicine, he told me. His interest shifted when he tried to reconcile his own successes as an acupuncturist with his colleagues' complaints about the lack of hard scientific evidence. At some point in my research, I asked myself, if the medical community assumes that Chinese medicine is just a placebo, why don't we examine this phenomenon more deeply? Some studies have found that when acupuncture is performed with retractable needles or lasers, or when the pricks are made in the wrong spots, the treatment still works. By conventional standards, this would make acupuncture a sham. If the drug doesn't outperform a placebo, it's considered ineffective. But in the acupuncture studies, Kopechick was struck by the fact that patients in the sham treatment group were actually getting better. He points out that the same is true of many pharmaceuticals. In experiments with post-operative patients, for example, prescription pain medications lost half their effectiveness when the patient did not know that he or she had just been given a painkiller. A study of the migraine drug rizatriptan found that no statistical difference between a placebo-labeled rizatriptan and an actual rizatriptan-labeled placebo. What Kapchuk found was that something akin to a blank spot in the map. In medical research, everyone is always asking, does it work better than a placebo? So I asked the obvious question that nobody was asking. What is a placebo? And I realized that nobody ever talked about that. Working with Kelly and other colleagues, he has found that the placebo effect is not a single phenomenon, but rather a group of interrelated mechanisms. It's triggered not just by fake pharmaceuticals, but by the symbols and rituals of healthcare itself, everything from the prick of an injection to the sight of a person in a lab coat. And the effects are not just imaginary, as was once assumed. Functional magnetic resonance imaging, which maps brain activity by determining small changes in blood flow, shows that placebos, like real pharmaceuticals, actually trigger neurochemicals such as endorphins and dopamine and activate areas of the brain associated with analgesia and other forms of symptomatic relief. Nobody would believe my research without neuroscience, Kapchuk told me. People ask, how does a placebo work? And I want to say by rituals and symbols, but they say, no, how does it really work? And I say, dopamine, and then they feel better. To understand the physiology, PIPS has begun sponsoring research into the genetics of placebo response. After meeting with Kapchuk, I went across town to the Division of Preventive Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital to see the geneticist Catherine Teo Hall. Hall studies a gene for catechol-O-methyltransferase, called COMT, an enzyme that metabolizes dopamine. In one study, she found that the type of COMT enzyme patients possessed seemed to determine whether a placebo would work for them. Is the COMT gene the placebo gene? Hall was quick to put their findings into context. The expectation is that the placebo effect is a knot involving many genes and biosocial factors, she told me, not just COMT. There is another layer to this, Hall pointed out. Worriers. People with higher dopamine levels can exhibit greater levels of attention and memory, but also greater levels of anxiety, and they deal poorly with stress. Warriors, people with lower dopamine levels, can show lesser levels of attention and memory under normal conditions, but their abilities actually increase under stress. The placebo component thus fits into the warrior-warrior personality type, as one might expect. Warriors tend to be more sensitive to placebos. Warriors tend to be less sensitive. I told Hall a little sheepishly about my one-man placebo trial, not sure how she would react. Brilliant, she said, and showed me a box of homeopathic pills she takes to help with pain in her arm from an old injury. My placebo, the only thing that helps. What might the future of placebos look like? Kapchuk talks about doctors one day prescribing open-label placebos to their patients as a way of treating certain symptoms without the cost and side effects that can come with real pharmaceuticals. Other researchers are focused on placebos' ability to help patients with hard-to-treat symptoms such as nausea and chronic pain. Still others talk about making conventional medical treatments even more effective by using the symbols and rituals of healthcare, such as getting an injection from someone in a white lab cloak, to add a placebo effect. Hall would like to see placebo research lead to more individualized medicine. She suggests that isolating genetic markers could allow doctors to tailor treatment to a patient's individual level of placebo sensitivity. Citing the research showing that empathetic caregiver is key, Kelly hopes to refocus our attention on the relationship between patient and caregiver, reminding us all the healing power of kindness and compassion. After I took my magic pills for 2 weeks, the writing capsules seemed to kick in. I found my sentences were awkward and slow, and I disliked them as much as ever. But I did not throw them out. I did not want to admit that in the self-reports I was keeping, sheets full of notes such as bit finger instead of erasing, when the urge to delete my work became overwhelming, I would grab a couple of extra capsules and swallow them. I was way, way over my dosage, had in fact reached Valley of the Dolls level of excess. I don't have to believe in you, I told them, because you're going to work anyway. One night, my 12-year-old daughter was having trouble sleeping. She was upset about some things happening with the other kids in school. We were talking about it, trying to figure out how best to help, but in the meantime, she needed to get some rest. Would you like a placebo? I asked. She looked interested. Like you take? I got my bottle and did what John Kelly had done for me in the office, explaining the scientific evidence and showing her the impressive label. Placebo helps many people. It helped me and will help you. She took two of the shiny yellow capsules and within a couple minutes was deeply asleep. Standing in the doorway, I shook two more capsules into the palm of my hand. I popped them into my mouth and went back to work. Were open placebos show promise? Much of the research into the effectiveness of open-label placebos has been conducted by Ted Kepchuk and his colleagues with encouraging results for a number of different conditions. Irritable bowel symptoms. Study subjects who took two placebo pills daily reported greater improvement in symptoms after just 11 days than those who took simply continued their usual treatment, such as fiber or antispasmodics. In other research, 44% of patients given sham acupuncture for irritable bowel syndrome experienced relief. That jumped to 62% when the practitioner was supportive and sympathetic. Chronic lower back pain. Patients who took clearly labeled placebo pills twice a day reported greater pain reduction and reduced disability compared with those who just continued their usual treatment, which often included non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs or other painkillers. Migraine. Those taking a placebo, whether it was labeled as such or as a medication, got just as much pain relief as those taking medication. Fatigued, caused by cancer treatment. Those who took placebo pills twice daily reported a 29% improvement in fatigue level, higher than the 23% reported by those who took medication or treated their fatigue in other ways. And with that, let's switch over to the Consumer Reports. Why you should eat more fish. And there's a picture of a beautiful hunk of salmon. Whether it's grilled salmon, peel-it-yourself shrimp, or festive clam bake, fish and shellfish are often the centerpiece of summer meals. Packed with lean protein and low in calories, seafood is one of the best things you can put on your plate. It's also the richest source of omega-3 fatty acids, a type of polyunsaturated fat that is important for your heart and brain health. A heart-healthy habit, omega-3s are important for cell communication in heart muscles and for cells within the lining of the arteries, says Eric R. Kim, scientific doctor of science, professor of epidemiology at nutrition at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health in Boston. These fats may reduce harmful inflammation throughout the body, prevent heart rhythm problems, improve the flexibility of arteries, and lower cholesterol. For all these reasons, the American Heart Association recommends eating at least 2 weekly servings of non-fried fish, especially fatty fish, to get these benefits. A serving is about 3.5 ounces of cooked fish or 3/4 cup of flaked fish, such as tuna or canned salmon. This past spring, the AHA ratified this 16-year-old recommendation in a new advisory based on a review of the latest research. There is substantially more evidence now pointing to seafood intake and lower risk of coronary heart disease and sudden cardiac death, especially when the seafood replaces less healthy main dishes such as beef or pork, says Rim, the chair of the AHA's writing group. Among the key findings, people who ate 1 or 2 fatty fish meals a week, that's a tongue twister, had a 50% lower risk of sudden cardiac death than those who ate little or no seafood. Those who ate 1 serving of fish a week had a 14% lower risk of ischemic stroke, the type caused by blood clot in the brain, than people who ate little or no fish. People who consumed seafood 4 or more times a week had a 22% lower risk of coronary heart disease overall than those who ate it less than once a month. It's possible that going beyond the recommended 2 servings a week could provide additional health benefits, but hard evidence is lacking. There just aren't a lot of studies that included consumption at a higher level, Rem says. Based on the available evidence, the researchers concluded that much of the benefit comes from moving from very little or no fish in the diet to eating fish 1 or 2 times a week. However, if fish is consumed 4 or more times a week as a substitution for other less healthy foods, then I do think that more is better, Rem says. Mind your mercury. One downside of increasing the amount of fish you eat is potential exposure to mercury, a toxin that could affect brain development in fetus and young children, and in excess may affect the health of adults as well. It's healthy to eat fish, and you can even eat a lot of fish. You just need to pay attention to which fish are high and low in mercury, says Jean Halloran, Director of Food Policy Initiatives at Consumer Union, the Advocacy Division of Consumer Reports. There are accurate neurological risks of too much mercury, even for adults, from cognitive issues to tremors and loss of balance. The heavy metal is in the ocean from mercury released by coal-fired power plants and other industrial or natural sources, such as volcanoes. Mercury-containing plants and tiny animals are eaten by smaller fish that are then gobbled up by larger fish, whose tissues accumulates mercury. That's why larger, long-living predators, such as sharks and swordfish, tend to have more of the toxin than smaller fish, such as sardines, sole, and trout. Big-eyed tuna, often used in sushi, gulf tilefish, king mackerel, marlin, and orange roughy are other high-mercury fishes. Some of the fish that are low in mercury, Atlantic mackerel, salmon, including canned, sardines, trout, are rich sources of omega-3s. Other low-mercury fish, such as catfish, flounder, tilapia, shrimp, and sole, supply less omega-3s, but they can still contribute to your overall intake, Halloran says. As for canned tuna, Halloran says previous consumer reports analysis of mercury levels in tuna suggest that pregnant women shouldn't eat it at all. Everyone else should opt for Chunk Light, which has one-third of the mercury of albacore and about one-fifth of the mercury in sushi tuna, and not make canned tuna the only type of sushi they eat. Fish Safety 101. Like many foods, fish and shellfish should carry pathogens that can make you sick, including bacteria such as Salmonella and Vibrio fulminificus, and occasional viruses. In my opinion, seafood is unique because some of it, such as oysters, is eaten raw, and other seafood is not cooked with as much heat and time as you would cook chicken, for instance, says James E. Rogers, Ph.D., Director of Food Safety Research and Testing at Consumer Reports. For most people, a bout with foodborne illness is unpleasant but short-term, causing symptoms that range from mild stomach upset to cramping, diarrhea, and vomiting. If you have a healthy immune system, it might just be an uncomfortable 24 hours, says Lori Wright, Ph.D., and Assistant Professor of Nutrition and Dietetics at the University of North Florida, and a spokesperson for the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. But for young children, older adults, and people whose immune system is compromised by health problems, such as diabetes or liver disease, it can lead to hospitalization or, even in rare cases, to death. Here's what experts advise to help you ensure that you're serving safe seafood. Reconsider raw fish. In addition to sushi, this includes ceviche, seafood marinated in lemon or lime juice long enough for acids to turn the flesh white. It looks cooked, but it really isn't, Wright says. Raw clams and oysters can carry Vibrio fulminificus, which in some cases can be deadly. According to the Food and Drug Administration, avoiding fish from polluted waters is not a guarantee that you won't get sick, and neither is abiding by the common misconception that it's safe to eat raw shellfish in months that contain the letter R. And contrary to popular belief, hot sauce and alcohol do not kill bacteria that cause foodborne illnesses. Be temperature conscious. Cook seafood to an internal temperature of 145 degrees Fahrenheit. For thicker fish, such as salmon, steak, slip an instant read food thermometer, preferably a digital one, into the side of the fillet. For shellfish or a delicate fillet of sole, the Department of Agriculture says it's also safe to cook fish until the fish is opaque and flakes easily with a fork. Cook crabs, lobster, and shrimp until the fish is opaque and pearly, clams, mussels, and oysters until their shells open, and scallops until they're milky white or firm and opaque. Refrigerate cooked seafood dishes within an hour or two of serving. If you're serving seafood cold, as in shrimp cocktail or salad, keep it refrigerated until you're ready to eat it. For picnics or buffets, place the serving dish in a bowl of ice so the fish stays cool, Wright says. When in doubt, throw it out. If you don't know or cannot trust how your seafood has been stored before it's cooked or maintained after cooking, it is better to dispose of it, Rogers says. Seafood can be pricey, but getting sick can be as well. Toss leftover cooked seafood after 2 days in the fridge. With all the heat we've been having the last couple of months, this is a pretty important issue here. Staying happy, healthy, and hydrated. Staying hydrated regulates body temperatures, allows your heart to work more efficiently, prevents headache and muscle fatigue, aids with digestion, and even boosts your mood. But in the heat of summer, it's easy to become dehydrated without realizing it. You might be tempted to try one of the many sports drinks or flavored waters on supermarket shelves, thinking they're a step up from plain old H2O. But what's the truth? CR's nutritionist took a closer look at the types of hydration drinks on the market. Here's their verdict. Sports drinks. These were originally developed for hardcore athletes to replenish electrolytes such as sodium and potassium that are lost in sweat, plus carbohydrates that muscles use for fuel. The average exerciser needs to replace water, not electrolytes, says Amy Keating, RD, a CR nutritionist. Worst, sports drinks could offset the calorie-burning benefits of exercise. A person who weighs 150 pounds will burn around 150 calories in 30 minutes of brisk walking. But sports drinks can have about 100 calories in 16 ounces, Keating says. Zero-calorie and low-calorie sports drinks might not have any or as much sugar, but may have artificial sweeteners, and both types might have artificial colors or other added ingredients. Water with added vitamins. There's no need to replenish vitamins just because it's hot out or you went for a run. And if you drink a lot of these, you run the risk of overloading on vitamins, especially if you take a multivitamin and or eat vitamin-fortified foods, such as certain cereals. Also, read labels. Some products are full of sugars. Plant waters. Labeling on certain coconut, maple, cactus, and other trendy plant waters suggests that these drinks are more hydrating than water or more natural alternative to sports drinks. There's not much truth to the hydration claims, but they are lower in sugars. Coconut water has 40 to 65 calories and 9 to 14 grams of sugar in 8 ounces. Cactus and maple have about 25 calories and 5 grams of sugar in 8 ounces. Iced tea. Brewed tea has negligible calories and contains antioxidants that may improve heart health and lower the risk of cognitive decline and type 2 diabetes. But when it comes in a bottle, tea might not have any of these benefits. Mineral bottled iced teas are nutritionally on a par with soda, containing loads of sugars. Diet iced teas will be low in sugars and calories, but they may have artificial sweetness such as aspartame or sucralose. Instead, look for iced tea labeled unsweetened. You can add a teaspoon of sugar or agave syrup to get far less sugars than in many pre-sweetened versions, Keating says. If you want antioxidants, brew up a pitcher. Bottled teas are very low in antioxidants compared to freshly brewed tea, says Joe Vinson, Ph.D., professor emeritus of chemistry at the University of Scranton, whose lab has analyzed a variety of teas. But the antioxidants dissipate over time. We found that once brewed, the antioxidant content went down about 10% a day, Vinson said. So don't make a bigger batch than you can drink in a day or two. Homemade alternatives. Do-it-yourself flavored waters are a healthy and tasty alternative to bottled drinks. Start with a large pitcher of ice water and add sliced fruit. Or try the idea below from Chad Leger, Exeted Chef at Red Mountain Resorts in Southwest Houston. A ginger peach cooler. Add 2 quartered peaches, or another stone fruit, and about 2 inches of peeled ginger root, thinly sliced. Fill pitcher with water and stir gently. Add fresh lemon verbena leaves or lemongrass stalks, if desired. Smart shopping at the farmer's market. It's easy to understand why farmer's markets are popular. They offer fresh local produce, plus a chance to meet people who grow what you're buying. But it's not always clear to shoppers whether the produce heaped all around is local, organic, or both. For starters, consumers need to know that local and organic are not the same thing. In order to call your produce organic, you, the farmer, have to be certified by the USDA, says Joe Mascabini, Ph.D., a vegetable specialist at the Texan A&M AgriLife Research and Extension Center in Overton. There is a paperwork to fill out, processes to follow, and you have to be approved. A certification agency accredited by the Department of Agriculture checks annually to make sure the farm is complying with organic standards. The exception: farmers with yearly sales of less than $5,000 do not need to be certified to use the term organic. Organic growers are prohibited from using most synthetic pesticides and fertilizers, as well as antibiotics, which conventional farmers may use on animals and certain fruit trees. Organic farmers also must take measures to protect water and soil quality. The USDA organic seal is your guarantee that the food you're buying was produced in ways that minimize harm to the health or in the environment, says Charlotte Vallehays, senior policy analyst at Consumer Reports and a sustainability expert. As to the question of what local means, the USDA says that more than 85% of vendors at farmers markets come within 50 miles of their location. Markets often permit growers only from a certain geographical radius and can be strict about people selling only what they produced. But others allow vendors to sell products they haven't grown or produced themselves. Every farmers market sets its own rules and has a manager, so if these issues matter to you, ask the manager for details. Ideally, Valet says, You'll buy fruits and vegetables that are local and certified organic. But if the food is just grown locally and doesn't have that organic seal, buying it still has many advantages, considering the fact that although many supermarkets carry local produce, much of what you find in stores has been transported 1,200 miles on average. Produce at farmers markets is often picked ripe and sold within a day. That translates into fresher, more nutritious food because the vitamins and other nutrients haven't had time to break down, says Lori Wright, Ph.D., Assistant Professor of Nutrition and Dietetics at the University of North Florida. How to afford organic. Farmers markets often get a bad rap for being expensive, but Wright says that's not necessarily true. They're selling what's in season and plentiful, so often they're able to sell it at a great price, she says. Plus, produce that hasn't been sitting in a truck for days will last longer, and that can save you money by reducing food waste. Here are other ways to help you afford organics. If you're a fan of, say, the baby-cut carrots you see in the supermarket, know that you are paying a premium for whole large carrots to be peeled and cut into small pieces. Organic whole carrots tend to be less expensive than non-organic baby-cut variety. Snack on organic fruits and vegetables. USDA researchers have found that fresh produce often costs less than sweet and salty snacks. Buy a share in a farm program. When you join a CSA, Community Supported Agriculture Program, you pay the farmer at the start of the season. Then you receive a share of the harvest weekly or biweekly through the season. In this system, you're likely to spend less than you thought you would if you bought the same goods at the store. Worried you'll have more fruits and vegetables than you know what to do with? You can also preserve them for the winter months by canning, drying, or even freezing them. Now, how about some dirt on dishwashers? New models clean better and more quietly, even while they use less water and energy. Our new ratings will steer you to a choice that will know your up budget and last as long as you expect. No more drippy dishes. Some dishwashers have a tough time drying because water pools in concave areas of the glasses and can evaporate quickly. And because of the interior humidity, says Larry Klufa, CR's dishwasher test engineer. To improve matters, add a rinse aid to the dedicated dispenser. These formulas break the bond between water molecules and dishes, allowing ample space between dishes for air to circulate, also aids in drying. The dishwasher might be the appliance we're most guilty of taking for granted, but if you've stayed in a vacation rental without one or suddenly had your machine conk out, you'll long for it as long as you're wrist-deep in sudsy water. If you ever wondered how much time dishwashers save you versus washing dishes by hand, Energy has calculated just that, about 230 hours per year. Today's dishwashers use 4 to 6 gallons of water to clean a full load, compared with 10 gallons a decade ago. Most of the ones we tested are Energy Star certified. They'll save nearly 5,000 gallons of water per year and use less than half as much energy as washing dishes manually, according to Energy Star. And many new models are quieter than their predecessors thanks to better installation. But that's not all that's changed. Some manufacturers have modernized the look, moving controls to the top edge of the door so they're hidden from view when the door is closed, ditching the brand logo, replacing the bar handle with a research pocket. With no logo or handle, a stainless dishwasher from any manufacturer can fit seamlessly into a kitchen with stainless appliances from other brands. When shopping, take a close look at how the dishwasher's interior is configured. More space between the tines allow you to fit bigger plates and bowls, for example. Can you move the silverware basket? A flexible design that works with the way you cook is ideal. So take 2 of your everyday plates and a bowl with you. Whether your dishwasher bit the dust or you're unhappy with its cleaning capabilities, or you're simply ready for an upgrade, given the above, we've got new and improved ratings that combine our test results with survey data for predicted reliability, and overall performance. What your money can buy. For $500 or less, you don't have to spend a ton to get top-tier performance, says Larry Cuofo, CR engineer who runs our dishwasher tests. Some appliances sell for $500 or less earned an excellent in our cleaning test, and some ace drying an even more difficult task. But at lower prices, wash times can be longer, and most machines are relatively noisy. Another consideration, soil sensors. These devices improve cleaning and water efficiency by adjusting the cycle time and the amount of wash water based upon each load, soil level. But not all music machines have this feature, and stainless tubs, which resist stains better than plastic, aren't a given. For $600 to $900, move up to this price range and you'll get more peace and quiet while your dishwasher is running, says Min Kemp Bryant, a senior market analyst at CR. Sleeker styling and convenience features, such an express cycle that quickly clean lightly soiled items, might make it worth spending more. Expect a stainless interior, more finish options, including black stainless, and adjustable racks that can shift up or down to accommodate large and odd-shaped items. You'll see more models with hidden controls, special washstands for reusable water bottles or pots and pans, and a third rack on top that allows you to spread out large utensils. For $1,000 and up, these dishwashers come with useful and innovative features, says Bryant. You've seen models with LEDs that shine light on the dishes when you open the door. Wi-Fi-connected dishwashers allow you to control your machine from your smartphone and receive updates on the cycle status. At this upper tier, you'll also see more European brands, and their rack configuration may differ from U.S. brands. Again, this may affect how your dishes fit in the dishwasher. The most reliable brands. In Consumer Reports' latest dishwasher survey, we asked CR members about the 75,000 appliances they purchased between 2007 and 2017. The eight brands below represent, in order, the most reliable in our survey, rated either excellent or very good for their predicted reliability. You'll see ratings for this, along with those in the owner satisfaction, in the charts later. If reliability is a concern, look for a model from one of the top-tier brands. Bosch, Thermador, and Whirlpool are the top. The very good are Miele, GE, Amana, and IKEA. How to give your dishwasher staying power. No rinsing required. Escape food, bones, etc. from dishes before loading them into the dishwasher. Various dishwasher manufacturers tell us their appliances are built to last roughly 10 years. That lines up nicely with the average length of time people expect theirs to last, according to Consumer Reports' latest dishwasher survey. But many factors can affect a dishwasher's lifespan, including how you treat it every day. Scrape. Don't rinse plates. Of course you don't want bones, toothpicks, and globs of food going into the dishwasher, but there's no need to rinse your plates. In fact, the soil sensor detects little or no debris, a lighter wash will follow, possibly leaving your dishes dirty. Stick to safe materials. That jar of jelly you want to recycle, hand wash it. Labels on glass jars can become unglued during a trip through the dishwasher, clogging the filter and jamming the pump. Not all plastics are dishwasher safe. Some will melt in a dishwasher, and pieces can break off and wind up in the plastic and wind up damaging it. If the plastic is labeled dishwasher safe, place it on the top rack. And skip cycles that use higher wash or dry temperatures, such as the sanitized cycle. Higher heat can cause harmful chemicals such as phthalates and BPA to leach from plastics that contain them. Always run full loads. Dishwashers have mechanical parts. And the more you use the dishwasher, the faster those parts will wear out, says Larry Cuofo, who runs CR's dishwasher tests. To reduce the number of cycles, run full loads rather than partial ones. Avoid strong chemicals. Chlorine bleach and degreasing agents can affect how long the key components, such as the hydraulic circuits, pump, and seals, last. Add salt if you have hard water. If your dishwasher has a built-in water softener, use a regeneration salt following your manual's instructions. This improves cleaning, helping to prevent spotting and clouding. The salt also helps prevent mineral buildup in the dishwasher. Be mindful to keep it clean. Run the clean dishwasher a cycle as often as your manual specifies. Regularly rinse away food stuck in the manual clean filter and wipe away food trap between the door and the gasket. What's the strangest thing you've ever put in your dishwasher? We put this question to our members and also queried the manufacturers. They confessed to some pretty weird items, including fish and car parts. But putting things in a dishwasher that aren't deemed dishwasher safe can damage the item, the dishwasher, or both. Car parts. Some members have tried to clean hubcaps, racing auto valves, and vintage wheel covers. But grease from machinery can clog the wash system, preventing water from circulating and shorting a dishwasher's life. Used paintbrushes? The chemicals in paint, especially the oil-based type, can damage key dishwasher parts, such as the filter and pump. Those chemicals can also wind up in a dishwasher's water line and land on dishes and glasses. Garden tools. Soil on the garden tools can damage dishwasher components. These appliances are designed and tested to handle small food particles, detergent, and rinse aid. That's it. Well, here we go. Bras. With no agitation and no tumbling, you can sort of understand why someone might be tempted to put bras in a dishwasher. But the heat can damage them, and dishwasher detergents aren't ideal for cleaning delicates because they often contain degreasers and bleach. Cast iron cookware. Seasoning and baked on oil help form a slick surface for cooking and prevent rust, but a dishwasher takes it away. Computer keyboards? Even if the keys come out clean, water might linger inside and damage the keyboard's functionality. Crocs. It might seem like the easiest way to clean these plastic slip-on shoes, but a dishwasher's heat can shrink or warp Crocs. Fish? Some people cook salmon wrapped in foil in their dishwasher, but it's questionable whether certain foods, like fish and eggs, are heated well enough to kill microorganisms such as salmonella. Insulated mugs. Water and high temps can damage the vacuum seal between the inner and outer layers, and once water gets in that seal, it can affect the mug's ability to retain heat. Dishes with gold leaf, brass, or bronze. Discoloration or fading are both possibilities with any gold leaf detailing on dishes or china. High temps and detergent can discolor or pit brass and bronze. The same is true for copper and pewter. Sharp knives. They can become dull after rubbing against other cutlery in the basket. Some dishwashers have a top rack for large utensils, but we still advise hand washing good knives. Wooden items. Wood, water, and heat aren't a great mix. Wood cutting boards, salad bowls, and utensils can warp or crack. Okay, I'm going to start this next section, even though we won't finish it in this session, but we'll come back to it next week. Sick of confusing medical bills? Hospital doctors and insurance bills riddled with incorrect or unexpected charges are shockingly common, confounding and enraging consumers. Learn why our medical billing system is so broken and what you can do to protect yourself and your finances before, during, and after a medical procedure. In May 2015, Chris Bound, a 32-year-old web developer living in Los Angeles, sought medical help for depression. He was hospitalized for 4 weeks. The charges for a stay and treatment at one point came to $33,415. It should have been affordable because of Chris's health insurance coverage. But the hospital billing department sent a portion of the claim to the wrong division of the insurer. When the hospital didn't get reimbursed, bills ranging from $140 to more than $11,000 started arriving at Chris's home. The typical clerical error set off a 2-year medical billing ordeal for Chris, who moved to Modesto, California after his hospitalization to live with his parents. His mother, Sharon, 65, worked in medical insurance billing before retiring, so she thought she understood the system. But even she was stymied. "I knew enough to know he wasn't getting the reimbursement he was owed," she told Consumer Reports. Over the next month, Chris and his mom placed scores of calls and sent as many emails to the hospital and the insurer. Sharon kept a folder of notes that grew to be inches thick. "Every time I called, it was like starting over, having to re-explain everything to a new customer service rep, and none of them seemed to have clear information on their end." Meanwhile, the hospital sent Chris's account to a collection agency, although it was eventually removed from collections after the bill was disputed. Dignity Health Northridge Hospital Medical Center, where Chris was treated, declined to comment on the case for this article, citing patient confidentiality. In a spring 2017, an exasperated Sharon finally reached a consumer service rep in the Resolution Department of the Insurance, Blue Shield of California, who promised to help get the issue sorted out. The rep told Sharon to write a special consideration letter explaining the details of the case, something she had not previously been instructed to do. The rep also found a supervisor in the hospital billing department to look into Chris's situation. In August that year, more than 2 years after treatment, the hospital acknowledged the billing error and mailed Chris, who had been making payments, a $943 refund. Sharon said the balance is now zero. "We were very fortunate we got someone to help us," Chris says. A broken billing process. If the Brown saga sounds familiar, that's because it's being replayed around the country as millions of Americans struggle with medical billing problems, everything from inaccurate charges to surprise fees to wrongly denied claims. No one seems to be tracking national data on healthcare billing issues, but problems are exceedingly common. In a recent nationally representative consumer report survey of 1,000 insured adults who included major medical bills in the past 2 years, 2 out of 3 said they had at least one billing issue, such as higher-than-expected charges, unclear statements, and bills arriving months late. And because the medical bills themselves are so confusing, filled with specialized terms and lacking clarity about whether you or your insurance is responsible for payment, millions of Americans give up trying to fight them. According to the CR survey, more than one-third of respondents said they paid bills they weren't sure they owed. 20% of that group paid more than $1,000. Among the reasons they gave for doing this, the bill was too confusing. They were uncertain their efforts would make a difference, and they were concerned not paying would hurt their credit record. The medical billing system is so inefficient and complicated, people don't even know how to make a dispute, says Marvin Gaynor, professor of economics and health policy at Carnegie Mellon University. They just throw up their hands. Of course, few Americans can afford to pay medical bills they may not owe, let alone ones they do, and the dysfunctional system is wrecking people's finances. Nearly 2 out of 10 in the CR survey said their credit score was affected by an unpaid medical bill. Nearly 3 out of 10 people in the survey said they had unpaid bills sent to collections. Of those, 61% said they could not afford to pay, 24% didn't realize they owed, and 21% lost track of the bill. And I'm going to fill a little time in here with some quotable quotes. Money doesn't buy happiness, but it can provide more comfortable despair. Your world is only as small as you make it. Gabriel Union, actor. The best way to cheer yourself up is to try to cheer somebody else up. Mark Twain. Compromising is okay, but compromising who you are as a human is not. Kelly Clarkson. The more you talk, the less people listen. Mitch Landrieu. I'm one of those people who get up on the right side of the bed in the morning. I get up, have a cup of coffee, and go to the gym before I can talk myself out of it. Dick Van Dyke, actor. And with that, we've just about run out of time for today's broadcast of the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. If you'd like to thank all of our past sponsors for their generous contributions to the Reading Service. If you have any comments or questions or would like to be a sponsor, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. So long until next time, and thanks so much for listening.